But first, the conversation and some remarkable guests on stage. Anthony Lewis is what the Greeks would call a seer, a columnist in the New York Times, and a man who has written with incredible detail and faithfulness and passion about refugee questions in our world. Terry Rusch is the director of resettlement programs at the U.S. Department of State. She's our first guest from the State Department. And Seamus Yeksakaya is himself an asylum seeker from Kurdistan, or as he calls it, Turkish-occupied Kurdistan, probably the largest people, nation in the world, without a state. Tony Lewis, I'd like you to begin with the sort of the essay question, the big picture question that I keep wanting to know, which is, in a global world, global economy, global culture, in which capital moves at the speed of light and goods flow for all our prosperity, what is the future? What should be the future of all this micromanaged control of the flow of people?
Well, there's a paradox in even in the way you put the question, because we do have a one world economically and capital does flow instantly, but that's not true of the movement of people. Nation states remain very powerfully determined to control their borders, all of them, and those who are rich, relatively, not just the United States. For example, South Africa, which is not at all a rich country compared to us, but it is compared to those across its borders, like Mozambique or Zimbabwe, the people of South Africa are angry at the government for not keeping out more Zimbabweans and Mozambicans, because they say, just as some Americans say, they're going to take our jobs away. One thing I've noticed, I'm straying from your essay question, but one thing I've noticed about Americans is that if you put questions to them in the abstract, should we absorb large numbers of refugees, should we take in immigrants and so forth, as a generality, they'll shy away very often and say, no, we can't do it, it's too much pressure on us. But if you tell them the human stories, if they know what's actually involved of somebody who's fled for his life from Turkish-occupied Kurdistan, as Seamus puts it, or many of the other cases I've dealt with, Americans respond and understand that we have a moral responsibility to take in our share. After all, this is a world problem, and there are world systems, there are treaties, there are arrangements, which no doubt Rusch will tell us about. And we have to play our part. We're bound to play our part, and it's morally right that we play our part, and furthermore, we can afford it. We're a rich country. And lastly, we can afford it in a different sense, because the people who come to this country as immigrants, as we're all testimony to this, in time make a contribution. I will tell you that one of my grandfathers, came to this country from Russia at the age of 12. Why did he come? Alone. Why did he come? It's not sure, but it seems likely that his family sent him out to escape the Russian draft, the czarist Russian draft. He was a refugee in his day and turned out all right. So we have to think about that.
I'm glad we are a nation of immigrants, and it's important in all these considerations. It was also important to Athens that they thought of themselves as a free state and a refuge. I want to know what you learned from all the feedback on all those columns in which you stuck your neck out for mercy. Again, it's an issue in the play. What did you learn about us and where we're going? Compared, say, to South Africa, compared to Fortress Europe, is it still possible?
Yes, I think it is. After all, this country takes in a large number of ordinary immigrants, not refugees, by statute, by planning, millions every year. And we have a different tradition. This is a country of immigrants. We're proud of that. Europeans are just learning about it, because it's only in relatively few last years that they've had large influxes of people from other countries. We've had a whole history of doing that, from the beginning. And so we ought to be more free about it, more sympathetic about it, and I think we are on the whole. But there are, in this as in other things in this country, waves of hostility and panic to which 9/11 has no doubt contributed. And that's what we have to watch out for, that our moral responsibility, our duty to bear a share of this necessity of taking in people who are literally victims of torture, repression, attempted murder, our share in saving them, that can be distracted by fear and scaremongering. We have to watch out for that.
Terry Rusch, I think of you as managing the sort of wholesale division of this thing. Resettlement of substantial populations, Vietnamese, Soviet Jews, Africans, among many others. I'd love you to sketch the program, especially as it has changed since the end of the Cold War, and all the more in the kind of security preoccupations of the last year or so.
Thanks. And thanks for your introductory remarks, Tony. That'll make it easier for me. This country has admitted persons who were fleeing persecution since we began as a nation. We didn't always call them refugees. We weren't really that interested in many instances why they were leaving, where they came from, or why they wanted to come here. We had a big territory. We had a developing economy. People were here. As long as they were healthy, that was good enough for us. After World War II, we tended to focus more. There had been a hiatus in immigration to this country in general during the Depression and during the war years. And at least as far as refugees were concerned, we were really interested in people who were fleeing communism. Then the United Nations developed the Convention on the Status of Refugees, to which the United States acceded in to the protocol in 1967, codified into our own law in 1980. Up until this point, our focus had been Indochinese refugees, in particular during the period of the 70s and the early 80s. Still Cold War, although the convention and our own law said we would be even-handed. We would reach out to refugees regardless of where they came from in the world. There was no longer this ideological or geographic restriction. We were dealing with hundreds of thousands of Indochinese, and followed by, when the Soviet Union started to fall apart, religious minorities that had been long denied the opportunity to reunite with family members that we also wanted to include. So this part of our embrace, if you will, of refugees as identified by the international community globally was somewhat delayed. But by the mid-90s, these large populations, largely of interest to us because of long-standing domestic concerns and foreign policy reasons, were starting to recede, and we started to expand through the United Nations and in community with other countries that were also resettling refugees. This brought us to every corner of the world. But no longer were we dealing with huge numbers of Vietnamese in Southeast Asia or Soviets from that part of the world, but we were dealing with small pockets, labor-intensive.
May I ask, why are the numbers down so radically?
This is part of it.
What is part of it?
The fact that it is now a much more dispersed effort. Instead of stamping out 120,000 persons from Indochina, which is a lot easier to do in five or six locations in Southeast Asia, and 60,000 persons from the former Soviet Union from one location, Moscow, we are talking about interviews taking place in 75 countries in recent years. Small pockets of unsuccessful coup members from Togo.
It's not that the problem has disappeared, including Iraqi refugees from Gulf War number one,
right.
Thousands of them still at the Rafah camp just over the border into Saudi Arabia, stuck there for more than a decade now. What is our responsibility to them, and what's holding them up?
25,000 people have been resettled from the Rafah camp. The original population was about 37,000. Some repatriated, some went to Iran, and about 25,000 were resettled, 50% of whom came to the United States. The others were dispersed through another 10 or 15 countries. We were the last country, I would also add, that interviewed in Rafah in the year 2000. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has recently negotiated a possible solution to the situation of the remaining 5,000, 2,000 of whom don't want to resettle anywhere. They want to stay in Saudi Arabia. So they're negotiating
with
the
Saudis. Can we hope to get that done before Gulf War II kicks off, shall we say?
Our position right now is that the United States is not prepared to return to Rafah. Other countries have said they will. And we're dealing now with 3,000 people maximum.
3,000 human beings. And Europe, right, meantime, is sending Iraqis back to the nation that we're getting ready to bomb.
I can't speak to that question. I don't think that we're deporting anybody to Iraq, because I don't know that there's, you know, any possibility of doing that. You have to have a responsible government at the other end if you wanted to deport somebody, but I don't think we're currently deporting people to Iraq.
Speaking of Iraq, I'd like to introduce Seamus Yeksekaya. He's a Kurd, as I said, and I think of him as sort of speaking for those nations, and there are others, including the Palestinians and the Armenians, nations without a state. Seamus, tell us the story of the Kurds and Kurdistan, and tell us your own story, your politics over there, and how you got here, and your vision of the future. Welcome.
Thank you. I just want to let you know that Armenia has a country, has a state, just in case.
Peace.
Yes. The Palestinians and Kurdish people has no states. Kurdish peoples are about 35 to 40 million people in Middle East without state, which is the biggest nation in the world. When you come to my story, it's a story of a Kurdish person who think Kurdish, who wants to live a Kurdish, of anybody from Kurdistan, same as everybody. I have came to the United States in 1999 from Turkish-occupied Kurdistan to get a fresh air, basically. And one of my friends, just we were having a conversation with, she said, "Well, Seamus, what do you think? You know, we came here, you're seeking asylum in here. What do you think?" I said, "My window has been a little bit changed. I feel like I am a citizen of the world instead of being a citizen of Kurdistan." Well, she said, "Why?" I said, "Well, I have been doing whatever I want, whatever I can read. I can write in Kurdish. I can speak. I can name my child a Kurdish in the United States. I can live as a Kurd in the United States, and there was no press on me to live as a Kurd, so that's why I feel, you know, more wide, looking at the world map instead of looking at Kurdistan map."
And
Tony has a thought.
Seamus, you were not able to do those things at home originally. You couldn't read, couldn't buy a Kurdish book and so forth. You were forbidden to do those things?
No, nothing. We cannot even name our child a Kurdish name. Our names has been changed. We have been completely denied.
Seamus, could I ask, I mean, we all know that the sins of Saddam Hussein against the Kurds are part of our indictment of the Iraqi regime, the gassing of Kurds, the mass slaughter. How much different are things for the Kurds in Turkey?
Basically, when I look at the world map, you know, the Turkey is on the left, Iraq is on the right. No matter what, when you go to a village in Kurdish and Turkish-occupied Kurdistan and a village in northern Iraq, there's no difference. Same. The village is burned. The village is burned. The village is gassed on the right-hand side. The village is probably not gassed, but it's burned, including people, including animals, everything. The United Nations and United States, I call them, that's my opinion, I call them a left eye has been closed like a pirate that I call a teenage pirate, is looking at a map, closed their left eye, and just looking at the right-hand side. This question I ask to myself, and just there is no answer to myself. Why there's nothing going on in Turkey? Why we're going to invade Iraq because of human rights, because of they have occupied or they have killed or tortured or killed people. It's the same thing, exactly the same thing going on in Turkey, and we don't see that. And actually, we see that. Why we don't act? Why don't do what, we don't do anything else? And it's hard to understand to myself.
I'd like you to tell the story of your own political activity and the trouble it got you into, including prison.
Well, during 1987 to 1999, I've been prosecuted, tortured, and beaten eight to nine times in Turkey. I have left Turkey in 1996, came to United States, had 1 year education about hotel management, and went back. I went back to Turkey in 1997, but I have, continued my, I was working with three organizations. One was ADAP, which has been closed. Another was ÖZDAP, which has been closed. Another then became HADEP, then they have closed. Then now is they have opened another party. Another organization was I was working for is Mesopotamian Culture and Organization, which is looking for the Kurdish rights and living Kurdish culture, have lived Kurdish culture if it has been permitted. It's been shut down many times. They've been arrested. They're continuing. I was just one of them. And another organization was the human rights organization in Turkey. I have been involved to all of them. I have, of course, been involved to protesting government, of burning villages, of killing innocent people, of keeping people in jail for 40 days without lawyer. And during this time, I have been arrested, I have been tortured, I have been detained. And
I'm wondering, Terry and Tony and all of us, how do we come to understand this? Of course, Kurdish politics is tainted in Turkish terms as extremist and even terroristic. How should we think of it? And why does Turkey not allow any of this political organization to get headway?
Well, if you go to Kurdistan in Turkish occupied region, if you live as a Kurd, think as a Kurd, there is a terrorism, which they call terrorism, that the organizations were fighting against the Turkish government, but there's also state terrorism in Turkey.
I'm a little surprised that you were allowed, given our alliances with Turkey, to get into this country. Tony?
I was just going to say that the attitude of the United States government over many administrations toward the question of the Kurds and Turkey is indicative of how self-interest, as perceived by politicians, rules these matters rather than some consistent view of human rights or national rights. We were pro-Kurdish when it suited us to annoy Iraq or annoy somebody else, and then when the moment came that we wanted to draw that conflict to a close, we just abandoned the Turks, the Kurds. We did nothing about the gassing of the Kurdish villages, nothing. We didn't say a word. Now we're very upfront about it. We denounce Saddam for using poison gas against the Kurds because we're trying to build up a case against Saddam. But when it happened, we didn't say boo. It's
Terry
national
Rush,
interest.
Please. Terry?
I don't know, profess to know great detail about the Kurdish situation, but I've been to Kurdistan once in eastern Turkey. And that was to initiate a program for the resettlement in this country of Iraqi Kurds who had fled Saddam's chemical warfare, who were allowed sanctuary in Turkey by the Turkish government. There were about, I think, 20,000 people there between the three camps, possibly more. So, that says something, I think, that we shouldn't ignore that about the Turks' willingness to do the right thing for human beings who are fleeing terror.
Somebody else.
Forgive
me. I should have said earlier that, of course, members of the audience are invited into the conversation. If you'll just raise your hand or stand, a microphone will be delivered to you.
We can't see you.
Instantly. I would love questions, answers, testimonials, as long as they're brief. Thank you. Seamus.
I wanted to tell you that the Iraqi Kurdistan has been poisoned or gassed in 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gulf War has started in 1991. So the 3 years between. Nothing happened. United Nations, including United States, did nothing when the Kurdistan has been poisoned by Saddam. Well, when Iraq invaded Kuwait, we went there and just took care of the situation. And this is a question to everybody as well. So the question is human dignity or human rights or the interest of big giants or kingdoms. I don't think there is a difference between 15th century and 21st century to me. In 15th century, every nation or every tribes, they would bring to their goals or to their everything to the kings, like annually, every month or every year, and do not be harmed by the kings. It's the same situation in the 21st century happening to the world, and that's the question to, and it's just I cannot answer it. The difference is time to me.
Anthony Lewis.
Well, I said earlier, and I didn't mean to sound cynical because I'm not, that these matters are often determined by perceived political or national interest, which changes over time, as you say. In 1988, we say nothing. In 1991, Saddam's an enemy. We say something, do something. But I think also that governments, and particularly the United States government, can be moved by human considerations. I don't think it's only politics. And I think that it's hard, even for a government as powerful and often it seems remote as Washington, it's hard to ignore entirely the human concerns. I instance you a case. It was a young woman from Togo called Fozia Kasinga who came to this country with a false passport, which she immediately announced when she reached the border at Newark, New Jersey, flew in, said, it's not a true passport, it's somebody else's passport. I'm seeking asylum because I was threatened with female genital mutilation. And I'm afraid of that. It's horrible, and I'm afraid I'll die, and I want asylum. And she was put in detention in a prison, a jail in New Jersey, for a long time, over a year. And there she was discovered by a New York Times reporter named Celia Duggar, and her story was told. And, you know, the story made a difference. First, she was let out on bail. Then the Board of Immigration Appeals changed its policy and announced that the threat of that operation was a sufficient ground to seek asylum. We recognize that as a ground for asylum. The original inspector, or whatever his correct title is, who had talked to her, didn't believe her story, didn't believe she was threatened. But Celia Duggar, this reporter, went to Togo, found her family, found that everything she said was true, and that her sister had died after having this operation. So the story was true, and the principle was accepted by the United States, I think largely because of this case. So, you know, human beings make a difference, and somehow, in all these things, we have to get through the bureaucratic or nationalist instincts and realize that there are human beings. That's what this play is about, isn't it? There are human beings there. It isn't just some abstract question. They're people. They're children. They're women. There's the old man. You'll see. That's what it's about.
Don't go away. I want to come back. First of all, are there thoughts in the audience? And hands to be recognized. Then I'll ask a last question. As mentioned, the Saddam's sins against the Kurds are part of the agitation for a war. What is the chance, Seamus, that a war with Iraq could bring something like nationhood, could bring a significant improvement in the lives of the Kurdish people?
I have no hope from the war all the time. I have always believed I had no hope from the war. But
from the outside, so to speak.
I have no hopes from the war.
Okay.
But the point is, if United States invade Iraq, and also there is a Turkey, and they have about $150,000, we are in a capitalist country, we always think about money. I said dollar, you know. They have 150,000 village guards. They have been paid by government to fight against Kurdish nationalism. They are thinking of putting these guards into the northern Iraq and invade there.
These are Turks now?
Yes.
Okay.
The village guards are Kurdish, but being paid by Turkish government. So again, there's a game as well. The same game as always played, the same tape as always played, to use these Kurdish guards against Kurdish people in northern Iraq to invade there, to get there and to invade there, to get the control of that and to give the control to the village guards, which has bad records in Turkey, including raping women, including killing people, including burning villages. These village guards are so dangerous. And when Turkey invade northern Iraq, which they're thinking of it, it's going to be a disaster, which already have established a little bad peace in their state in northern Iraq, northern Kurdistan. They have a little life on there, but I think if United States allow Turkey to invade northern Iraq, it's going to be a disaster.
Chris?
Please.
Question? Could you ask the audience, please, how many of them think that human rights has anything to do with our threatened invasion of Iraq? I'd like to see a show of hands as to how many think it is in any way a human rights issue or is not a human rights issue.
It's an interesting question, and let's do it.
I didn't hear you.
That's another question. We may get to that. There will be multiple choices here. But the first question is, a show of hands, everybody who thinks that the war against Iraq is driven basically by human rights considerations, raise your right hand.
And can't hear
wave,
you.
Wave your arm and you'll get a microphone.
He says it's not a fair question.
You're asking the question and asking for a particular
answer. Say it again on mic.
I said it's a loaded question. You're asking the question in the way that it requires a certain kind of an answer. Why does it have to be that that's the complete reason for the invasion of a potential invasion?
Didn't say
of
complete
Iraq.
Reason. Said a major well, a major piece of the impetus.
It's a variable. I mean, it's a variable. It's one of the issues. It's not the only issue.
It is an issue. I agree with you, but it's an issue that would never have. Did not engage the United States government in any serious way, certainly not to the point of a war, until it became a building block in the case for war. And I think that was it was a rather argumentative question, I agree with you, and that was the point of the question. Sure, that's true. But, you know, I can't resist adding a point, which is that for those like me who long favored active intervention by the United States in places where massive cruelties were taking place, notably Bosnia and Rwanda. Military intervention I favored, and I think I was right, and I'm glad we intervened when we did, stop the war. It's hard now to cope with what some would advertise as the further notching up of that policy, which is to invade Iraq. I think it's very different, but you understand that there is a relationship and it's worrying.
Could we hear a little more from Terry of just a bit of the human face of what she has to deal with in her job and some of the internal tensions now that are going on in this extraordinary position she's in?
Could you repeat the question?
The human personal tensions in your job, Terry, and the considerations that wake you up at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Fortunately, it's not the State Department, it's INS that makes the individual decisions. So that's a burden that they carry. We do the policy. As I was saying earlier, having a more dispersed program makes it far more labor and intensive and less cost-effective. So we're operating in lots of places around the world, many of which are less and less secure. For example, we were supposed to be processing 7,000 Liberians, long-suffering Liberians, from Ivory Coast this year. Well, guess what? In the last couple of months, nobody's doing anything in Ivory Coast. And some of the Liberians themselves are returning to Liberia, where they feel it's safer than it is in Ivory Coast. Post 9/11, we're dealing with huge security concerns. This has further slowed the process. There are name checks and family relationship checks and all of this that has to be done. I think it's a legitimate concern of the American people that we know who we are admitting as refugees at considerable taxpayer expense. That said, we have a resettlement infrastructure nationwide, voluntary agencies that have offices in every state, and they have institutional concerns and staffs to, you know, keep busy, that sort of thing. So there's a numbers pressure that comes from that.
What do you take to be the popular pressure out there among the real people, and are you as cheerful about it as congenitally optimistic and generous Tony Lewis?
I think both because of 9/11 and because of the economic downturn, we are hearing, as we often do, more concern about immigration than we do during times when, you know, jobs are plentiful and nobody's worried, or fewer are worried about their own economic situation. There are, however, more voices on the issue of how much immigration and how fast is too much for the United States to absorb. And that point of view is coming across perhaps because of the very diversity of the program, the immigration to this country and the refugee program that we've experienced in the last 10 years, people are more visible. When Bosnians came or Soviet Jews came, they weren't as visible as some people who wear have different skin colors and wear a different dress. And maybe that's it. We are hearing more, and our NGO affiliates are hearing more across the country. People wondering, are we, trying to do too much too quickly?
The play's the thing, as Shakespeare said. You'll be astonished how many of these issues resonate out of it. I love that New York Times headline when Peter Sellers opened this production in Germany last summer. The headline said, "What did Euripides understand about refugees?" Answer, everything. So let's take a short break, and please enjoy the play. Thank you.